This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Digital Underground podcast. Today's guest is Ron Dibert from the University of Toronto, who I think many in the audience will know from his work with Citizen Lab and their research on surveillance technology, as well as a lot of other very cool security research they've done in the last few years. Ron, thanks so much for joining me. It's taken a few months to actually get this done, but I'm happy we found a time to connect.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I kind of wanted to start at the beginning with Citizen Lab, and how did the idea for this group come about? Because I think the first time I became aware of what you guys were doing was probably with the GhostNet stuff a few years ago.
Yep. So actually, it was founded in 2001, and I'm a political scientist with an interest in information technology, security issues, mostly from a global political perspective. And throughout the 1990s, I was pretty much on a conventional academic track. I was a professor who was researching and writing on my own. And I felt like I'd kind of hit a wall in terms of what I could say meaningfully without really understanding more about how the technology worked and how the infrastructure of the internet worked. And right around that time, I was fortunate to receive a call out of the blue from the Ford Foundation, which is a philanthropic foundation in the United States. And they were looking to seed projects in the area of information technology and international security. And I came up with this idea of creating an interdisciplinary research lab that would bring together computer scientists, engineers, with social scientists to work broadly on in the area of global security, internet issues from a broadly human rights perspective. And it took us a while to get on the global spotlight, I would say, but we've been doing this work for quite a long time now.
And that was, I mean, that's been a long time now, 11 or 12 years since you started that, or since the whole thing started. And I mean, aside from, folks at the EFF or places like that, I can't recall anybody else doing that kind of work, that long ago. What was the landscape like at that point?
Well, I would even go further and say to this day, within the academic community, you find very few centers that are doing this type of research that is truly interdisciplinary, but that's a different conversation. Back then, I think there was still very much a conventional wisdom that the internet could not be controlled, that it was bringing about liberation, especially in the developing world and with respect to authoritarian regimes. We knew a little bit about censorship in places like China and Saudi Arabia, but really the landscape was still unclear. And so what we wanted to do at that time was put to the test this conventional wisdom. Is it really true that governments are not going to be able to control this technology? Mm-hmm. And we started out by doing some very simple experiments, mostly vis-a-vis China, but then we broadened out to eventually doing research in dozens of countries around the world with partners throughout the Global South on, broadly speaking, what I would call information controls, which include internet censorship, surveillance, but also computer network attack and cyber espionage.
Okay. And at the beginning, as you said, you were sort of coming at this from a political science perspective.
Yeah. I had a background in security issues. I did some work for the Canadian government, so I was aware of the intelligence world and the role that technologies play in international politics, especially not just signals intelligence, but satellite reconnaissance and some of the competitive ways governments are trying to control infrastructure and telecommunications. Mm-hmm. So to me, again, coming at this from an international political point of view, I was looking at the discourse, the conversations within the internet community, and my sense was, man, this is hopelessly idealistic. Yeah. These people have no idea what's going on beneath the surface, and that's kind of what I wanted to correct. And I realized to do that properly, I'd have to employ people who could put their skills to work on projects that I would help shape.
And, despite the work that you guys have done, and I think a lot of other people have done in the last decade or so, I still feel like a lot of the folks that use the internet on a daily basis have kind of that idealistic view of it. Maybe the events of the last 6 months have knocked that down a few notches, but
yeah.
I still feel like the general public kind of looks at the internet as this really nice open platform for, you know, enabling whatever project they happen to be working on.
Absolutely. That's a central thesis in my book, Black Code. In fact, one of the allusions meant by the title is to get at this, what I think is a paradox today, that as never before, we surrounded by so much technology, and yet as never before do users lack a basic understanding of what goes on beneath the surface of that technology. And with the Citizen Lab, and even in my own, you know, my own writing and teaching and lecturing, I've tried to undermine those preconceptions or that mythology that it's just a special kind of magic. You know, most people send an email or a tweet and they just don't think about it. You know, it magically appears on the other side of the world. When in fact there is this, first of all, not only this complex material infrastructure, but also that's where politics essentially plays itself out deep within the bowels of the internet. As you say, now we're finding out thanks to Edward Snowden.
Yeah, and I think bowels is probably the right word for a lot of what's been going on.
Literally.
Yeah, exactly. So, your book, I wanted to get into that, Black Code, if people aren't aware of it. Came out earlier this year and is kind of not a compilation so much, but just kind of a overview of some of the projects that you and the Citizen Lab folks have worked on and some of the more interesting episodes that you've been involved with. So how did the idea for the book come about, or did you just sort of look around and thought, well, man, I've got all this really interesting material we've, you know, gathered over the last decade. Now is probably a good time to put it into a, you know, one volume.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have an anecdote in the book where I explain that the title of the book actually goes back to the very beginning of the Citizen Lab, when prior to setting up the Citizen Lab, I wrote an article for the London School of Economics called Black Code, in which I outlined what I saw then as kind of threats brewing on the horizon around internet censorship, surveillance, even militarization of cyberspace. And that article was meant to be a framework for a book. And when I set up the Citizen Lab, part of the rationale was also to develop a research capacity that would inform the book. And instead, what happened is that I got sidelined into these amazing, almost like X-Files type investigations.
Yeah.
That took us down so many different paths. It was so exciting and exhilarating on a day-to-day basis that the book kept being put off. And then finally, 2 years ago, I said, okay, I've really got to sit down and write this. And the idea was to write to a general public audience, not an academic audience, some of the experiences that we've gone through and what they represent in terms of larger issues and concerns I have around not just the future of the internet, but the future of global politics as a whole.
And even back then, writing, you know, a decade ago or more, 12, 13 years ago, the concerns that you had around censorship and surveillance and those sort of things, could you have sort of pictured the environment that we're all working in now?
Well, not exactly, obviously. You know, things like the rapid embrace of social media and cloud computing and mobile, the way that we've kind of turned our digital lives inside out, I don't think really anyone could have fully anticipated. And that's, to me, a change on the level of historical epochs. You know, we talk about communication revolutions all the time, printing press and so on. But for me, the biggest one has happened just within the last 5 years or so in terms of how much personal data we now entrust to third parties, most of them private companies, including data that we're not even conscious of. So, you know, tracking data related to our cell phones and so on is a good example of that. But back then, keep in mind that I was setting up the Citizen Lab coinciding with the events of 9/11 and having a background in intelligence and understanding what the consequences of that would be for something like the internet. I fully anticipated this is a game changer. This is going to change the way that states, generally speaking, approach this domain, which up until that point they'd kind of left alone. You know, I said, well, that's going to change now. And certainly it did.
Yeah, and it's changed in so many ways over, I mean, it, certainly the last decade, but even just the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, even just since you guys published the GhostNet report, which I think was 2009.
Yes.
And was really, I think, at least the first one that I remember being sort of laying out exactly how a large-scale cyber espionage operation worked and what the targets were and how these kind of thing, you know, kind of a division of labor type situation. And, you know, since then, I think a lot of there's been several of those, but that's really the first one that I remember sort of giving very detailed description of how something like this is going on.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the process around it, we were very lucky and stumbled upon a mistake, really, that enabled us to see all of what was going on behind the backs of the attackers. But up until that point, most of the detail around this was either speculation or unsubstantiated. You might hear a news report about this or that company. But outside of classified circles, there really wasn't a detailed report like this that put together not just the technical part, but also the political analysis around it. One of the things I'm most proud of with respect to that report is that we took seriously this idea of competing explanations. So we actually had a parting of ways with researchers at the University of Cambridge with whom we were collaborating up until that point, around in part the idea of, well, this is all China. And as a almost pedantic point, but I think in hindsight is very important to make, we said, actually, you know, the fact that we have access to the command and control infrastructure means that, you know, we could take this information if we had no ethics and sell it to the highest bidder, and that means anyone else could be doing that too. So we have to be careful about weighing different alternative explanations here. And also, I think with respect to the Chinese, knowing now a lot more detail about how espionage emanates from China, certainly the Chinese government is involved in some manner, but there is also this huge black market for the fruits of cyber espionage that is linked to the world of cybercrime. And that was an important point to make, I think, as well.
Oh, absolutely. And there's, you know, I think you guys make the point in there as well that attributing all, you know, cyber espionage operations to China, which has become something of like a reflexive response these days, like, oh, it must be China, is not the right approach. Like, there's plenty of governments out there doing it, mine, yours, everybody else's.
Sure. And the neat thing, I think, from an academic point of view, is the difference between them, the different tradecraft and techniques. So, you know, one of the interesting, you know, characteristics of this space is the fact that there is so much Chinese-based espionage going on. I mean, we still work with human rights organizations, dozens of them that share data with us. And it's remarkable how many of them are compromised in some manner by attacks that connect back to China.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this kind of attack of, you know, sort of distributed attacks coming from China, and then more precise attacks undertaken by other governments that maybe leverage the infrastructure or clever backdoors in various ways, whereas the Chinese, they just throw everything at it and hope that something sticks.
Right. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that there was a mistake in the GhostNet operation that gave you guys sort of your in on that one. What was the mistake that they made?
So that's the other thing, is the Chinese are very sloppy. They tend to leave traces all over the place of what they do, and that partially explains why we also see so much Chinese-based espionage, is that they don't hide their tracks very well, and they're kind of careless about it. So in that case, really it boiled down to one person, Nart Villeneuve, who was our senior security researcher at the time. He now works for FireEye. He, in looking through the Wireshark data that we collected in the field from computers at Tibetan organizations, noticed a 22 character string that kept coming up in the Wireshark data, and he just took it, copied and pasted it, and Googled it. And a result came up for a website that was in Chinese. He clicked on the result, and it took him to a directory that was not password protected. That was essentially the a matrix of the command and control infrastructure of that the Chinese had set up for the GhostNet espionage campaign. And that was, you know, allowed us to see a number of other victims than the Tibetans. And we could see from the names given to the computers some very interesting, you know, like Indian Embassy, Washington, D.C., things like that, that said, okay, we've got a huge espionage network here. And from that, we kind of did more careful research. But really, it was just almost like an accident. Of course, Nart's intuition is infamous, and I think he's done that on more than one occasion.
Yeah, his name's been on a few of these things over the years. Yeah. Your point about them being sloppy, do you think that that's just a function of them not necessarily caring very much whether they're discovered?
I think that if you look at some of the good analysis of the Chinese cyber espionage ecosystem, you have activities that are clearly focused on political or industrial espionage targets that are more professionally organized, that tend to cover their tracks in a more effective manner. But then you have all this other stuff that is very sloppy and that appears to be coming almost out of university-based projects, as if it's an assignment for an instructor. And, you know, there are mistakes made on that level, which is plausible because, you know, within computer engineering courses in Chinese engineering universities, you can imagine there being, you know, some tasks assigned. Okay, go out and get what you can, see what you come back with.
Yep.
So I think it's it represents the ecosystem of Chinese cyber espionage, which is highly distributed and sometimes very unprofessional.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you hear the phrase Chinese cyber espionage, everybody thinks of, you know, the top of the mountain, you know, the best guys coming after them. But like everything else, there's probably several layers. You know, there's the really good guys. There's the guys that are, yeah, you know, they're not that bad. And then they're, you know, the rest of the crowd that might be doing some things as well and might have some wins. But in a lot of cases, you're going to get a lot of losses as well.
And yep. We see attackers uploading their Trojans to VirusTotal to kind of evaluate, you know, and we know these are the guys that are hitting the human rights groups, and it's remarkable to see that going on.
Well, thank God they're doing that.
They're doing a great public service as well as refining their Trojans.
Yeah. So speaking of some of the human rights stuff, a big focus for what you guys have been doing the last couple years especially has been on kind of the surveillance and government Trojan side of things. How did that work first come about?
Well, in part it's a evolution of work that we had been doing on the internet censorship and surveillance market that would emerge out of our research on documenting controls on a country-by-country basis. So going back to 2005 is the first time I can remember, we noticed in Iran that they were using an American product called Smart Filter to censor the internet. And we released a report at that time that was, you know, fairly notorious. I think the New York Times covered it. And that led us into a kind of an assembly line of work where we started, as we call it here in the lab, fingerprinting commercial products used for internet censorship and surveillance. A big boost to that work came when Morgan Marquis-Bohr, who is a senior security researcher at Google, contacted us at the Citizen Lab and said he'd like to, you know, he has this day job at Google that he can't really talk about, but on the side, he'd really like to do some work with Google and or with the Citizen Lab. And so we developed an arrangement where he's done these very focused systematic research projects along with a number of other people, Claudio Guarnera and Bill Marzak, essentially refining this method of fingerprinting signatures related to products and services around what many people call digital arms. I don't think that's the best term for it, but you know, products like FinSpy or those put forward by Hacking Team, mostly European companies that are sold to regimes that routinely violate human rights. And it's certainly been one of the most interesting, exciting new developments in the Citizen Lab.
Yeah, I think it's really important work that you guys and Morgan and Claudia are doing on that front.
Thanks.
It's great. And I don't think that, you know, I follow this stuff as closely as probably anybody. And I don't think there was a huge awareness before these reports started coming out that there was this, you know, small but you know, somewhat growing group of companies that are selling, you know, surveillance and, you know, what's known as intrusion technology to these governments around the world. You know, there's some people in the security and privacy community obviously knew, but I don't think the general, I mean, you know, it's not something the New York Times knew about or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, and it's to us, I think we were struck by how some of these companies were essentially taking the tradecraft of cybercrime and putting it in a brochure and marketing it for tens of thousands of dollars, which is incredible. And then we'd be seeing this showing up in some of the world's nastiest places. So clearly there was a problem here that needed to be addressed. And I think the lack of transparency around it had to do with the fact that these companies were selling their wares at trade shows that were restricted to accredited defense law enforcement agencies and so on. I think my first awareness of this actually came around the time of GhostNet. I'd heard about, you know, obviously the industry long before that, but when GhostNet came out, I saw a kind of gold rush mentality or around the idea that, geez, maybe we could take some of this tradecraft and sell it, make a profit from it. And a lot of people getting into the business of putting out threat reports that are essentially designed to market their wares. And that really began to concern me, and it made me underscore the importance of having independent university-based research.
I'm interested to hear what's been the reaction that you guys have gotten from this research, you know, from, you know, say governments like the U.S. or Canada or, you know, what we would think of as you know, democracies, as well as perhaps from the regimes that are using these things. What do you hear, whether through formal or informal channels?
Well, I think for the most part it's been fairly positive. When GhostNet came out, certainly members of the defense intelligence community, let's call it, in the United States, in Washington, D.C., were extremely receptive to it. And so that was a bit odd for me, being invited to events and to deliver talks to people, you know, from three-letter agencies who were you know, for them, it was strategically very much like the Mandiant report recently. You know, was, aha, we told you this is going on, and here this independent group of Canadians has shown what we were warning about. But then they would be confused by the fact that we're also writing critical of, you know, maybe NSA overreach or the surveillance industry that they're a part of. Yeah. So it's confused a few folks. In Canada, you know, at a government level, the concern is very much a conservative one. It's very much about public safety and security. And so I don't really have much formal exchange with the Canadian government. I don't think they necessarily appreciate what we're doing. I got some weird signals around the time of GhostNet that made me feel like perhaps some people in my own government would wish that we weren't doing this, that we were stepping on their territory. Uh-huh. You know, that's the nature of the Canadian government right now, unfortunately, not very much into internet freedom issues.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be not an uncommon problem. Mm-hmm. with governments right now. Your book came out, it came out in the spring, is that correct?
Yeah, it came out actually the day before Edward Snowden fled to Hawaii. And so that was really actually very good timing. I mean, there's this big fear when you write a book that some new event will happen that will discredit your thesis or something.
Absolutely.
Some, but in my case, it was like the heavens opened and a chorus rang out, you know. So each day there would be like new evidence coming out and data coming out that essentially riffs on the themes of Black Code. So I was very appreciative. And if I knew where to send it, I'd send him a signed copy of the book. We just released a paperback version, or Random House did, that was, I guess, 3 weeks ago now. And it includes a new author's preface where I talk about Edward Snowden and his revelations. And then I also added a timeline in the back of the paperback version, 104 years of Anglo-American surveillance, just to put it in some historical perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right about the timing part. I mean, your publisher must have been jumping up and down when, you know, when you see what's going on and how, you know, history is, or not history, but current events are lining up with exactly what you've written. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, this surveillance thing is not exactly a new problem. It's obviously one of the oldest professions in the world. It's just that it's sort of moved online and everybody has started to use this globally available platform as their tool for, I forget who wrote it in one of the reviews of your book, but they said, you know, everybody just uses it as a way to get information out of whoever they want, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's attackers or the government or users, or, you know, they're all using it as a tool to get information out of somebody. Where do you think things are? I mean, where do you think the next step is in terms of surveillance, or maybe the reaction to everything that we've found out in the last 6 months?
Well, you know, it certainly lifted a lid on activities that were shrouded in secrecy, and has kind of underscored the extent to which there were huge resources being devoted to gathering signals and data from these major platforms that are now in which we are essentially now immersed. And, you know, my hope is that this will trigger a kind of almost like a constitutional discussion, only on a global scale, for something like a new social contract, because we've gone through this incredible sea change in how we communicate at the very same time that we're entrusting enormous resources to these essentially Cold War agencies that operate in the shadows. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. And I think, as we're beginning to see with rulings in the United States that the judge made yesterday on the constitutionality of it,
yep.
I think that that's all well and good for Americans to debate that. But meanwhile, what about the rest of the world? So we've got a scale problem here, that you have these global networks that are primarily owned and operated by American companies and being tapped into by the American government by nature of the fact that they're headquartered in the United States. Where does that leave the rest of us? So there's both a, you know, a privacy security issue in an abstract sense, but then a really important geopolitical question that we have to address moving forward. Unfortunately, I think in the short term, the biggest impact of those revelations is going to be a negative one. And by that I mean we'll see governments using the excuse of the Snowden revelations to put in place more draconian national controls and develop their own versions of the NSA in the global south that could come back to bite us. And that's what worries me most. The digital arms market that we talked about, I think they're right now, they must be licking their chops at the prospects of countries building out their own signals intelligence capabilities under the pretense of protecting themselves from NSA surveillance.
I think that's an excellent point. I read something very recently, within the last week probably, of somebody saying, you know, just that people could be in other regimes in, you know, developing countries looking at that, this is a blueprint, is okay, this is how you surveil your citizens. Mm-hmm. And we can put something in place that looks like we're, you know, trying to protect them against, you know, US or UK or Canadian surveillance, and at the same time get, you know, a really nice picture of what our own citizens are doing at any any given moment.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the vast majority of internet users are not coming from Silicon Valley anymore or from even Europe. They're coming from the global south, from governments in places where governments have no public accountability really to speak of in a lot of the countries. And, you know, the most recent Citizen Lab reports have focused on mobile chat applications in Asia that are extraordinarily popular, like KaoKao, WeChat, Line, and so on. Mm-hmm. And many people might not be surprised, but others should be, that, you know, these applications build in by design surveillance and keyword filtering because they have to comply with local laws there. And I think we're going to see only more of that now as these governments put pressure on developers to conform to their surveillance requirements.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. So what's the next focus for the Citizen Lab research team? What are you guys looking at for the next year or so?
Well, you know, I'm surrounded by an extraordinary group of people now. I'm really fortunate. I mentioned the team around Morgan and John Scott Railton. We're working collaboratively with other groups that are more on the advocacy side when it comes to the digital arms market, like Privacy International and others.
Yeah.
So we'll continue doing our part in that, which is really just about the research. And I think there's some exciting methodological developments there that I, you know, don't really want to talk about now, but we'll be publishing them shortly, I hope. Ways to better fingerprint those type of technologies. But we're also looking at, you know, this mobile messaging and chat universe in Asia, I think, is extraordinary. Like I said, there are very few people over here are aware that there are hundreds of millions of people using these very popular applications that are growing in leaps and bounds in markets that are the future of the internet, but they're building surveillance by design into them. And to me, that's a really interesting research front for us to focus on.
Yeah, it seems like there's plenty of opportunities there. And you're right. Whenever I travel overseas, you see people using these chat apps that you've never even heard of. Mm-hmm. But everyone in the country has it, you know.
Exactly.
And they're also communicating with, you know, probably friends or family, maybe in the U.S. or, you know, in Canada or the U.K. and places. So it certainly has a, you know, global impact.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
All right, Ron, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was a great chat. And
my pleasure. It's been fun.
Look forward to seeing what else you guys have coming out soon.
Great. Well, nice to chat. Good
Thanks,
luck.
Ron. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.